Sitting of Parliament Friday 30th of May 2014. Bill, first and second reading. A bill for an act to reenact with amendment the provisions of the Companies Act 1907, as amended, to incorporate the Companies Accounts Act 1999 and the Companies Consolidated Accounts Act 1999 to take account of the effects of the Insolvency Act, to incorporate amendments proposed by a Law Reform Committee of the Gibraltar Finance Centre Council, and for connected purposes. The Honourable Minister of Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to re-enact with amendments the provisions of the Companies Act 1930, as amended, incorporate the Companies Accounts Act 1999 and the Companies Consolidated Accounts Act 1999 to take account of the effect of the Insolvency Act, to incorporate amendments proposed by a Law Reform Committee of the Gibraltar Finance Centre Council, and for connected purposes, be read a first time.
I think this is probably the shortest bill that I've seen in the last 40 years. I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to re-enact with amendments the provisions of the Companies Act 1930. 1930-07, as amended, to incorporate the Companies Accounts Act 1999 and the Companies Consolidated Accounts Act 1999, to take account of the effect of the Insolvency Act, to incorporate amendments proposed by a Law Reform Committee of the Gibraltar Finance Centre Council, and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Companies Act 2014.
Speaker, I beg to move that the bill for a new Companies Act be read for a second time. The bill brings the government's manifesto commitment in this area closer to completion by providing a much needed and thorough review of the present Companies Act and related legislation. It has been said throughout the industry that the current Act is in need of a wholesale review to update it in line with the needs of the Gibraltar Finance and Industry. As Parliament is aware, the review involves consideration of proposals put forward by the Company Law Reform Committee set up by the Finance Centre Council, and its consultation process, which culminated in the publication of a command paper. The bill before Parliament today incorporates a number of issues which were also raised during the command paper consultation period. The process has involved input from the Association of Trust and Company Managers, AFCON, Companies House, the Financial Services Commission, the Gibraltar Society of Accountants, Gibraltar Funds and Investments Association, and a number of fund administrators as well as individual legal practitioners. Since the bill was published, further representations have been received from the Gibraltar Fund and Industry Association, Fund and Investments Association, related to the filing requirements of certain regulated entities, and I will deal with that particular point later. The aim of the bill, Mr. Speaker, is to consolidate and codify existing practices, as well as to modernise the current Act in preparation for, amongst other things, electronic filing at Companies House. The bill is made up of 18 parts, 490 clauses, and 29 schedules. Rather than go through these provisions one by one, the House will, I'm sure, be very happy that I should only refer to occasions where changes have been made to the existing provisions in the current Companies Act. If you think in Part 2 of the bill deals with formation of companies. This part of the bill includes provisions. 1. Expressly allowing a company limited by guarantee and an unlimited company to have a share capital, which is current practice but not expressly provided in the law. 2. Reducing the number of persons applied for the formation of a public company from 7 to 1. 3. Including a statutory definition of public company. 4. Removing the requirement for opt-out clauses in a memorandum of association, resulting in a shorter form of memorandum. This follows from the presumption in clause 21(3) that a company is authorized to carry on any type of local business, making redundant the requirement to list the types of authorized business in the memorandum. 5. Allowing a company that is a collective investment scheme the option to formally notify the registrar that it is a CIF within 30 days of establishment of the scheme. This option is based on submission received from Gibraltar Funding Investment Association. A further amendment was proposed by this year after the bill was published and will be presented at committee stage. A letter setting out the proposed amendment has been sent to Mr. Speaker and I understand circulated to all members. It will be proposed that clause 18 be amended to include a step clause 2, which provides that any notification given pursuant to section 18 shall confirm whether the company is a private scheme as defined in section 2(1) of the Financial Services Collective Investment Schemes Act 2011. The reason for this is that there are distinct exemptions which apply depending on whether it is a private scheme or otherwise. Collective investment schemes which are not private schemes are afforded more exemptions. 6. Removing the current 50-member maximum for a private company, bringing our legislation in line with the equivalent UK Act. Section 369 of the current Act is also being reviewed so that a partnership with more than 20 members is no longer required to be incorporated as a company. 7. Removing the requirement to file a statement of incorporation containing details of a first director before the company may be incorporated. 8. Setting out clearly the documents to be included in the company's application for registration. These include a statement of capital and initial shareholding, if applicable, a statement of guarantee, also if applicable, a statement of proposed offices, a statement of the intended address of the registered office, and a copy of the proposed articles of association. Mr. Speaker, Part 3 of the bill deals with the company's constitution and powers. This part includes the following provisions. 1. Defining a company's constitution by including the company's articles and any relevant resolutions and agreements. The current Act refers to company constitution throughout but without a definition. 2. Providing that the validity of an act done by a company shall not be called into question on the ground of lack of capacity of such company. The reason behind this change is that those dealing with the company should not bear the risk of the company claiming that dealings in question are ultra-virus and therefore void. 3. Empowering the minister by regulation to prescribe model articles of association for companies. The current tables A to E will be replaced by model articles, which will only apply to companies incorporated after the introduction of those model articles. Clause 488 provides that until the model articles are introduced by regulation, tables A to E containing Schedule 1 of the current Act will continue to have effect. 4. Changing the time limit for sending amended articles of association to the company type. This is changed from 15 days to 30 days, so as to standardize time periods throughout the bill. A number of additional variations are made to this part regarding the changing of the company's status, such as private company to public company and vice versa. This conversion is currently possible, but is not expressly provided in the current Act. Public company to unlimited public private company, company limited by shares to company limited by guarantee having a share capital, company limited by guarantee having a share capital to company limited by shares, and limited company to a company limited by shares or guarantee. There is also clarification as to the requirement to be satisfied by a company when executing deeds and documents. Part 4 of the bill, Mr. Speaker, deals with prospectuses, share capital, and debentures. These include the following new provisions or amended provisions. 1. For an exception to collective investment schemes, which means that this type of company is not required to file returns of allotment at company type. There is a proposed amendment to this clause, clauses 188 and 189 of the bill, pursuant to representations made by this year. In order to ensure that all collective schemes are passed, we have made reference to section 18, which is the obligation to notify the registrar. This section captures all collective investment schemes. 2. prohibition on financial assistance shall actually enable a company to give financial assistance for the purchase of its shares by another entity, so long as certain provisions are complied with. A private company can give financial assistance under the bill if its net assets are not thereby reduced, or to the extent that they are reduced, if the assistance is provided out of distributable profit. A company looking to provide financial assistance, unless it is a wholly owned company, would be required to 1. Pass a special resolution, 2. Cause the directors to make a statutory declaration, and 3. Engage an auditor to prepare an auditor's report confirming the statutory declaration. It should be noted that the 1. Definition of what constitutes financial assistance has been tightened to reflect the provision under the UK's 1985 Act by the inclusion of the word or any other subsidiary. And 2. The proposal is to reflect the position, as I said, under the 1985 Act, in spite of the fact that in 2006 the prohibition was relaxed in 2008 in the UK. And this is, Speaker, an area in which I have some correspondence with the Honourable Minister David Rufino, and I have explained the rationale for the decision that has been taken to introduce where that essentially sent white force provision rather than removing the prohibition of financial assistance altogether. I'd be happy to deal with any other point that Mr. Rufino raised in connection with this in my response. 3. A CIS will no longer be required to deliver a return to the registrar when purchasing its own shares. 4. All companies having a set capital will be able to use fractional shares unless prohibited under this constitution. 5. Creating an exemption for CIS in relation to the need for a notice to the registrar of consolidation of share capital and conversion of shares into stock. Again, there is a proposed amendment to this clause at committee stage. 6. The introduction of a new type of protection for members against being unfairly prejudiced. A member or the minister may apply to the court when such member feels that the company's affairs have been conducted or are proposed to be conducted in a manner that is unfairly prejudicial to the interests of members generally or some part of the members. Clause 147 sets out the type of order that the court may make if it finds the petition to be successful, including ordering the company to refrain from doing any act complained of. These clauses have been largely taken from the UK Act. The reason for this change is to bring the protection of members in line with that which exists in the UK. 7. A new requirement will be introduced that all companies, except for a company which is a CIS, file a prescribed form of company type within 30 days of any change in its members or in any of the particulars contained in the register of members. Currently, there is no statutory provision for the filing of a change of members. 8. A statutory basis is created formalizing the current practice of allowing the redenomination of debt capital. It's not going to be open. We'll be open. 9. The removal of all references to bearer shares as a result of the abolition of share warrants to bearer implemented by the Companies, Partnerships and Trusts Miscellaneous Amendments Act 2012. Mr. Speaker, Part 5 deals with registration of charges. In this part, there are amendments to the time period for registration of charges created by companies registered in Gibraltar. Clause 168 and 171 extend the period for registration of charges by companies registered in Gibraltar from 21 days to 30 days. The period for charges over property situated outside Gibraltar has also been extended from 21 days to 30 days after the date on which the instrument could have been posted. The bill still contains an expression given to the registrar in cases of late filing of documents received from abroad. Clause 168 also clarifies the law which emanates from the Slavenberg case. Section 128 of the current Act requires registration of every charge created by a company registered in Gibraltar. This includes companies registered in Gibraltar under Part 10, which is place of business registration, or Part 14, branch registration. Since the Slavenberg case, it has also become common practice to present for registration charges over present or future property in Gibraltar created by overseas companies which do not have an established place of business or branch in Gibraltar. If the company is not send them to the sender with a standard form of letter as proof of delivery, but the document will not be registered. This practice was also carried out in the UK, but was removed as a result of Section 105C of the UK Act. Clause 168(11) makes it clear that only charges which are created at the time where the company is registered in Gibraltar will require registration. Currently, there is no statutory procedure for the registration of charges by a company which re-domiciles into Gibraltar from another jurisdiction with existing charges and mortgages registered against the company. Clause 168(8) of the bill includes provisions for the registration of existing charges of re-domiciled companies and clarifies that the time period for registration commences the day after the company is registered in Gibraltar. Part 6 of the bill deals with management and administration. Provisions under this part include the following. 1. Formalizing the current practice of the filing of statements at company's house in relation to the authority of the company to use a registered address. There is currently a form which can be filed at company's house titled Statement that the company does not have authority to maintain registered address at specific premises. There is, however, no statutory authority to allow for this notice. We are therefore plugging this gap. 2. Amending the requirement that a company display its name outside its office to require such display at every office. In other words, not necessarily outside the office. 3. Regarding annual returns, clause 188 of the bill remains largely unchanged from the equivalent section 153 of the current Act, except that it provides an extended period of 6 months instead of 30 days after the date to which the return is made up for collective investment schemes to deliver the annual return to the registrar. Amendments exempting certain CISs from certain obligations in relation to annual returns will also be proposed at committee stage. These amendments are, as I have mentioned, the result of representations made by TRIFIA and they are following discussions with company accounts. As I have already mentioned, Mr. Speaker, TRIFIA made a number of proposals following which, and after extensive deliberation with leading individuals in the fund industry, it has been decided that the following amendments be considered at committee stage. A, Subclause 186 introduces an exemption for collective investment schemes which are not private schemes. These funds will be exempt from the requirement to provide the information listed in Clause 1884 in relation to its members in the annual report. And B, an exception has been inserted at Clause 1892 so that only private schemes are required to submit a statement of allotment, redemption, and purchase of its own shares. TRIFIA's reasoning for these proposed amendments is that EIS and other such funds are regulated by the Financial Services Commission, and as such, they are already under an obligation to submit information to the Commission in relation to their members. EISs which are not regulated are under no obligation to submit information, and therefore should submit the same information under the bill as non-EIS companies. And the government has agreed with the proposals submitted by TRIFIA and with the reasoning and rationale for those proposals. And that is why we are making those amendments to the bill, which are set out in the letter. The Speaker, Clause 197 of the bill has been taken directly from Section 309 of the UK Act, which sets out a requirement where a company wishes to notify the members of a meeting via website. The reason for this change is to bring the bill in line with the UK Act and to give companies the option to use technology as a means of communication with its members. There are similar provisions, including allowing for members to signify written approval by electronic means, allowing for the sending of documents relating to written resolutions by electronic means, and for the publication of written resolutions on websites. 5. The current Act refers to ordinary resolution throughout, but does not provide a definition of the term. Clause 200 of the bill codifies the definition, which is actually used in practice, namely, a resolution passed by members representing a simple majority of the total voting rights of the members. 6. Clause 205 provides where a company's articles prohibit the company from passing a resolution in the form of a written resolution, such provision in the article shall be void. 7. The time limit for the filing of resolutions is increased from 15 days to 30 days from the date of the resolution. 8. Clause 231 of the bill provides a new power to any person, not including the company, to indemnify a director against any liability, which by virtue of any rule of law would otherwise attach to him in respect of any negligence, default, breach of duty, or breach of trust, of which he may be guilty in relation to the tender. Additionally, clause 231 allows companies to purchase insurance for a director of the company, which is in addition to the existing power of a company to indemnify any director against any liability incurred by him in defending any proceedings, whether civil or criminal, in which judgment is given in his favor or in which he is acquitted. This clause clarifies that the rule against indemnifying an officer of the company does not preclude the company from taking out directors and officers' liability insurance. The new powers containing clause 231 are not provided in the current act. This change is a result of one of the various many proposals put forward by the Company Law Reform Committee of the Judicial Finance Centre Council. 9. Under clauses 232 to 236 creates a statutory basis for the remedy of a derivative action. I know the Honourable Professor Parana is very interested in this area. These new clauses allow a member to bring an action on behalf of the company in respect of a cause of action arising from an actual or proposed act or omission involving negligence, default, breach of duty, or breach of trust by a director of the company. In order to bring a derivative action under the bill, a member must apply to the court on behalf of the company for permission to continue such action. A derivative action may be brought only in respect of a cause of action arising from an actual or proposed act or omission involving, as I said, negligence, default, breach of duty, or breach of trust by a director of the company. This is Speaker, Part 7 of the Bill deals with accounts and audits. This part consolidates the Company's Accounts Act and the Company's Consolidated Accounts Act within the Company's Act. It seeks to remove any ambiguity which existed between these acts and the current act, as well as removing any inconsistency which existed with any other legislation, notably the Income Tax Act of 2010. Part 10 of the bill deals with liquidation. This part is divided into two chapters, voluntary liquidation and other liquidation provisions. Mr. Speaker, as a result of the new Insolvency Act 2011, and the Insolvency Consequential Provisions Bill, which I will be moving later on in this session, all of the insolvency provisions in the current Act have been transferred to the new Insolvency Act of 2011. The Companies Act will therefore only cover voluntary liquidation. Where a voluntary liquidation becomes an insolvent liquidation, the bill provides that at that stage the Insolvency Act will apply. Under clause 2 and 3 of the bill, the directors of a company are required to comply with the following requirements when making a statutory declaration of solvency. 1. They must make the declaration within 5 weeks before the date of the passing of the resolution for the appointment of a voluntary liquidator. And 2. They must deliver the declaration to the registrar for registration within 15 days after the date on which the resolution for 1 year is passed. 3624 of the bill introduces an offence with a penalty of up to 2 years imprisonment where a director makes a declaration without having reasonable grounds for giving such a declaration. This offence is inserted so as to ensure that directors do not sign the declaration, which is a declaration which could have very serious consequences for the company, without considering its content and validity fully. Part 11, Mr. Speaker, of the basis of general provisions up to registration. Clause 413 provides for a new requirement whereby the directors of a company must state in an application to strike at the company that the company has no assets or liabilities. This change clarifies the procedure for voluntarily striking off the company and is in line with common practice. Clause 41 of the bill introduces new requirements in relation to the authentication of a document sent to the registrar. 41.3 details how a company to authenticate the documents applied in electronic form. This form is introduced so the companies may take advantage of the e-filing platform developed by Company House. Clause 42 of the bill allows the registrar to impose requirements as to form, authentication, and manner of delivery of documents which have to be delivered to the registrar. Part 12 of the bill. These were companies incorporated outside Gibraltar, carrying on business within Gibraltar. Clauses 46 to 48 of the bill clarify the requirement in respect of the execution of documents by foreign companies. These allow foreign companies to execute documents and deeds by A, affecting the common field, or B, by any person who, in accordance with the laws of the territory which the company is incorporated, is authorized to do so. Part 18 of the bill deals with miscellaneous provisions. This part includes provisions regarding the sending or supplying documents or information setting out requirements that need to be filled or filled, be it in a document sent in hard copy or electronically, creating a right for a member to request a hard copy of a document and setting out the requirements for the authentication of documents, again being in hard copy or electronic format. Clause 48 to 490 of the bill set out the conditional provisions, controversial amendments, and repeals arising from the provisions of the bill. Peter, I move to schedules. The schedules to the bill are largely the same as those in the current Act, with a few exceptions, and include those schedules taken from the Company Accounts Act and the Company Consolidated Accounts Act, which are being repealed. Schedule 5 deals with annual returns. The form of annual return has been amended so that a company must also confirm the main activity of the company, the size of the company, the number of employees in its financial year end. Schedule 9 is the definition of a small, medium, and large company. The definitions of these companies have been amended to be brought in line with EU definitions. Schedule 23 is the powers of voluntary liquidator. This schedule is taken from clause 54 of the Insolvency Consequential Provisions Bill, which I will be moving later, and sets out the powers of a voluntary liquidator. Schedule 28 is an index of defined expressions. This schedule contains a table which sets out where to find definitions of terms used throughout the entire bill. Mr. Speaker, that concludes my run-through of the bill, in particular the new provisions of the bill and what this actually does. It is, in fact, Mr. Speaker, very satisfying for the government to see the vast amount of work which has been put in over more than 2 years approach fruition by the consideration of this bill by Parliament today. I mentioned at the outset, the second reading of this bill, the various organisations which have been involved in the process, and I would like to thank publicly them all. It would simply not have been possible for the table passed without their expertise and effort. In particular, I would thank those involved in the Company Law Reform Committee of the Finance Centre Council, who initially set out to consider the existing Companies Act and to make a substantial number of proposals to improve our legislation. And that is precisely what we are doing today. We will now have a modern, up-to-date and comprehensive Companies Act, which will give all practitioners the tools they require service the needs of a finance centre in a jurisdiction that can be regarded as a model of excellence for the whole world. Finally, I wish to thank all participants, both in government and the team of the SANS led by Ian Felice and Gemma Baskett, who have put this bill together in an extensive drafting exercise. They have had to endure numerous requests by me for explanations and clarifications as we painstakingly went to each provision of the bill. Mr. Speaker, it will be clear to honourable members that this is not just a reenactment of the current Companies Act with a few tweaks or amendments. This is a complete overhaul by way of a new act. The government recognises that it will take some time for practitioners to get to grips with the full effect of the act. It is therefore the government's intention, apart from the fact that the bill was published some time ago and the command paper was also published, it is now the government's intention that practitioners should be given around 3 months to fully familiarise themselves with the legislation and the related insolvency legislation before the aftermath. We are therefore proposing to commence the legislation, both this and the insolvency legislation, on the 1st of September 2014. Speaker, I commend the bill.
Before I put the question, I think the honourable member is to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill. Yes, Mr.
Mr. Speaker, this is sort of a baptism of fire, given that I was only given responsibility for financial services in my appointment by the leader of the Vietnam as executive leader about a month or two ago. Some would say it's a hospital cap, given that this is a bill which runs into almost 900 pages. But, Mr. Speaker, simply to be introductory comment would be that I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for going through this very lengthy piece of legislation in some form, in redacted form. I think that's something which will be welcomed by everybody in this House, and highlighting simply those changes to the current bill, which has in fact originally dated from 1930, based on the 1929. Legislative provisions in England and Wales. And I'd also like to, Mr. Speaker, associate myself with the comments made at the end by them, in the same sense of acknowledging the assistance provided by the Law Reform Committee and other groups such as AFCON, who mentioned at the beginning, Companies House, the Financial Services Commission, who's talked about the Baltimore Accounts Association, and others. And indeed, those professional competitors in Los Angeles behind the government benches now also acknowledge their assistance in this. Mr. Speaker, this is certainly welcome from the opposition benches as a legislative initiative on behalf of this government, one which I'm sure will also be welcomed by many practitioners in the field, such as myself, somebody who deals in company matters, considering the broadest term possible. The Minister is absolutely right in saying that this is a particular area of the law which is crucial to one of the very central sectors of our economic activity, that is the finance sector, and obviously all the ancillary services which are provided to it. The very important services provided by the legal profession, accounting professions, and I can think of corporate service providers and fund managers, for example. The introduction of this bill into our statute books is very positive and indeed complements the, in a very useful way, I think it has to be acknowledged by everybody, the sister legislation to this particular act, which is the Insolvency Act, which was introduced by the leader of the Lutheran. He was Minister for Justice when we were on the other side of the House, which is also another very important piece of legislative initiative in this particular area of activity. I would highlight a few of the points. One of them has already been acknowledged by the Minister in his address, and I would welcome in his reply any comments he wish to make in relation to financial assistance. But I'd like to deal first with the provisions, and he and I have discussed this behind the Speaker's chair in recent days. The provisions set out in clauses 72 onwards under the heading Execution of Documents by Companies. I have had some difficulty in reading those provisions, although I derive comfort from the fact that it appears that this wording is already the subject of settled interpretative law, in that as I understand it, there is I haven't read the acting in the details, but I understand that there is a Supreme Court decision of England and Wales which deal with this matter. But I just find it rather strange to see that the provision. Particularly, if I could highlight clause 72.1 and then the sub clause to that, which is 2. 72.1 states that a contract may be made A by a company by writing under its common seal or on behalf of a company, not by a company, the wording is slightly different, and I raise that because that's featured in the Supreme Court decision which I referred to earlier, and which is referred to me, indeed, rather hopefully, by the Minister to me when we've had this discussion. So, on behalf of a company, by a person acting under its authority, expressed or implied, presumably, that is contract as I see it, which would be entered into orally, for example. However, it may not necessarily exclusively deal with that, and I see that the Honourable Minister shakes his head. If a contract is then reduced to writing and therefore becomes, just reading on the face of the language of the bill, and therefore becomes a document, under clause 72(2), it says, a document is validly executed by a company if it is signed on behalf of the company, A, by two authorized signatories, or by a director of the company, and this is an important bit, Mr. Speaker, in the presence of a witness who attests the signature. Now, those of us who deal in this area of law and have to provide opinions to banks and other clients, the position, and I think this is correct advice that I've certainly been providing, is that if this is an ordinary contract, i.e., if it is not a contract which is entered into, for example, by way of deed, then the signature of a director or indeed an authorized signatory is sufficient without the requirement of that signature being written. And I see that as an added burden which didn't exist, or doesn't currently exist in the Companies Act that we have today. And that is something I would welcome the Honourable Minister's views on across, and to place on record across the floor of the House, I'm sure that will be of assistance to those of us who deal in this area of the law. Mr. Speaker, moving on swiftly to clause 100, I believe it is, under the bill, which deals with the prohibition of financial assistance. This is also a point which I raised with the Honourable Minister, and the point I raised is that, you know, in England, under the 2006 Act, currently enforced in England and Wales, the prohibition has actually been removed insofar as it impacts on private companies. As I understand it, the position in respect of the PLC, public limited companies, still exists. But as far as private companies are concerned, Mr. Speaker, it has been removed. The information that I received is that that was a reaction by the legislators in the United Kingdom to complaints made by those participants in the field as to the extent in complying with the whitewash provisions which now apply under this bill, i.e., the minister went through it, the requirement to have a shareholder resolution, the requirement to have a statutory declaration, presumably in relation to sovereignty, and also the requirement in particular of having an audited report. Those didn't exist in our current legislation. They don't exist in our current legislation. They have been introduced in this bill, and in fact, they have been now removed as a result of the 2006 Act in the United Kingdom. From speaking to the Honourable Minister, I'm sure he will mind if I may say so, the decision-making process which has influenced him in coming up with the wording in the current bill is not as a result of any government policy division, but in fact simply responding to the various representations which he has received. And he has explained to me, and I would certainly welcome him to explain to him, no doubt far better than I, that what was placed in the balance in England was that there was a codification of directors' duties. Directors' duties, which were in any event prevalent there as a result of development of the common law, but they were actually formally codified in the legislation in England in the 2006 Act. If that had been done, if that particular route had been taken by the government on this occasion, it would also have required the imposition of offences. And that is something which is placed in the balance, and therefore we felt that it was better to retain the pre-2006 position in England and Wales and retain the whitewash provisions despite the alleged cumbersome nature of them, because there was a reticence to impose offences in relation to those directors' duties. And I would welcome the Honourable Minister's contribution in relation to that particular point. And simply to mention minor points, the relevant something which is very close to my heart in terms of the area of law I do, the codification of the flag and the register, and that's something which is going to be working, very much working for those practitioners in this field. I think that a company has had a difficulty when we, as a matter of practice, have tried to follow the rules which are not codified, from my understanding of the bill and what the Minister has explained. They have had a difficulty in accepting those notifications from practitioners. Now, it is clearly set out, and it is clear for all to see that that is the procedure set out in something that I've worked very much working that from certainly from a personal perspective as somebody who deals in matters like this. And also, I found very interesting new clause 197, which adopts the practice in England in relation to the publication of notice of meetings on a website. And so that is also something which will be welcomed by particular. Mr. Speaker, that is the end of my contribution. And that's where the honourable the back end of the speech.
Thank you.
The honourable leader of the opposition.
Mr. Speaker, just to say this, Mr. Speaker, in the past I said that I couldn't have hoped for a better successor as Minister for Justice at the Honourable Gentleman. I think that the work that he has done in that area, I think, justifies the view that I've expressed publicly within the House. I commend him for the work. It's one of the quirks. It's one of the quirks of politics and living in a small community such as Gibraltar, that effectively, when the Honourable Gentleman opposite won the last election, the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Lukudi and myself, effectively switched roles. I inherited his practice, his legal practice within Hassan, and he inherited my role as Minister for Justice. And just as I am bringing, hopefully, to a successful conclusion many of the cases that he began when he was a legal practitioner, I congratulate the Honourable Gentleman too for bringing to a successful conclusion some of the work that we had commenced when we were in government and I was Minister for Justice. Not only has he done so in commencing the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act and also the Crimes Act, but also now this particular act enables him to commence the Insolvency Act. And I wish to just stand up and recognise it and commend the Honourable Gentleman for it.
Any other honourable member wish to consider before I call on the member to reply? Very briefly, as Minister of Financial Services, and working with the sector as closely as I do, I have to say that I'm absolutely delighted by the presentation of the bill by my honourable friend. I think he's done a quite stunning job in bringing together not just the private sector by itself, in other words, all the individual component parts, that are often pushing in different directions. But to bring the regulator on board, to bring companies half on board, to bring all the different facets, all in almost unanimous praise of the work that we have done, I think it's quite a staggering achievement. This bill is hugely important to the industry because it provides them with clarity, it provides them with certainty, and as long as the shadow minister for financial services has said quite rightly, it's a key component part of the work and one of the tools that the sector relies on to be able to go about its business. And to bring it up to date, to consolidate it, and at the same time to bring amendments which the sector is specifically requested, is an example of the partnership that we are all trying to engage in with the private sector that we work in to bring about the necessary tools for them to go about doing their business. So I certainly commend the bill, and I think what's made my little friend for the quite fabulous work that he and his team have done in bringing us this bill together.
One of the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, very often in this Parliament, we have had to endure in the past 30 months, this is, I think, our 23rd meeting of Parliament since we were elected, calls from the Honourable Gentleman to look at where we have made progress in our manifesto and where we have not. So I think it is incumbent on me to raise the point they might have been raising if we were at the last meeting of the lifetime of the Parliament, and we have not brought this bill, which would have been on page 66 of our manifesto. We show that we are committed to revising our company's registration and adopting a new and consolidated and revised act
as soon as possible. And this is full compliance with that commitment. It reflects yet another one of the commitments that we acquired at the general election fulfilled. And fulfilled, Mr. Speaker, as I think the House unanimously agrees, in fantastic and excellent fashion. Mr. Speaker, apart from giving the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister another good reason to tick a box and issue a detailed press release reminding members opposite and the rest of our community just how much progress we are making in the delivery of our manifesto, this bill demonstrates also, of course, something else. Gibbon Goody is not just, in my view, a worthy successor to those who have come before. He is undoubtedly, and without a shadow of a doubt, one of the greatest ministers for justice that Gibraltar will ever see. But he is not minister for financial services at the moment, Mr. Speaker, and neither is he minister for finance. And yet, this is a bill that he started working on when he was minister for financial services. He brings it to the House a year after having moved on from that portfolio, demonstrating the collegiate way in which this government works in a cross-ministerial way, always ensure that we deliver for our community in the best possible way and in our collegiate fashion, with full cabinet responsibility being something that all of us are very much aware of. But Speaker, I would say a few words about some of the people who have been in his team. They are the lawyers I have been working with since they arrived at Hassan's as baby lawyers, and they have done an excellent job in working with Mr. McGuinty. And this I commend, of course, to go to the House. I would be very pleased to see the House support this bill unanimously.
The Honourable Mr. McGuinty.
Mr. Speaker, I am very grateful for the comments that have been made today in the House. It's quite very flattering to receive those comments, not just from my colleagues in government, but also from the opposition benefit. It is true, as I mentioned at the beginning, that this is not the work of one man or one minister by a long, long term. This is the work, this is a collective work of not just the professionals who have assisted in actually putting it together, but a great many individuals, practitioners, and professionals who have been involved for 2.5 years in the process of consultation, collaboration, advice, and assistance to the government. And once again, I express my gratitude to them all. It is really a tribute to them that in a bill that we have before the House, which runs to almost 1,000 pages, that doesn't just reenact the current legislation that brings in substantial new provisions and amendments, that in all of those, there should be so little, in fact, nothing between them, but so little by way of comment or issues that need clarification. It really is a testament to the excellent work that has been done by those who have put this together. It is a tribute to them that that is indeed the position. The Honourable Member opposite Mr. Bofino has raised in particular two issues, and those are the same two issues that we have already been in correspondence with, and I have provided explanations for the views taken by the government on this, and I would be happy to provide those again. The two issues he raises are in relation to the execution of documents provisions at clause 72, section, and in relation to financial assistance provisions at clause 100. In relation to the execution of documents, as the Honourable Member has acknowledged, this has been taken from the equivalent provisions in the UK Act. Not the most frequent provisions that exist in the UK, those are reflected in the 2006 Act, that is in relation to financial assistance. But this is taken from the 2006 Act, the execution of documents provisions, 2006 Act. So they do reflect the most up-to-date practice, legislative practice in the UK. They have been in place since 2006, so for 8 years now, the UK has had these provisions, and from what I am told, they work well. and that they do not impose any particular onerous burden. It is also worth mentioning that this was one of the specific proposals that was made by the Company Law Reform Committee of the Finance Minister Council. They proposed that these particular provisions from the 2006 Act would be adopted and taken for Gibraltar. Not only was it a proposal from the industry, but following publication of the bill, and also in relation to the demand paper, when we published a draft of the bill and invited comments, we didn't have any particular issues or concerns raised as this created an added burden. I am assured that this creates a clearer scenario as to what is required to be done in relation to the execution of documents. I know, and certainly from discussions with my colleagues in the Finance Services, I know that we have had issues as a practitioner in the past as to what the current provisions in the Companies Act and what the current practice actually should be. And there has been some disagreement between practitioners. So there was a need, and that is why the proposal was made in the first place. There was a need to clarify the position and make it crystal clear. This was a proposal by the committee. It was a proposal that I accepted. It seemed to make sense, and I asked that the drafters include this in the draft bill that was presented to me. And when I saw it, I must say that I raised exactly the same point that the Honourable Member had raised in relation to this provision. Because it did seem to me at first blush that the requirement for certain documents to be signed by a director with a witness may in certain circumstances be more onerous. And in response to that, the raising of that issue, a specific paper was prepared for me in relation to these provisions. And I have in fact shared that paper that was prepared for me a number of months ago. I have shared that paper with the Honourable Member, and that paper refers to decision in the UK court, which sets out the jurisprudence on which has been developed as a result of these provisions. And the crucial issue which arises from that jurisprudence, and in fact it is on the face of the exception of the provision, is the distinction as to whether a document is signed by a company or on behalf of a company. And I am assured that it is as a result of what the provision say, the statutory provision, the interpretation of those provisions by the Court of Appeal in England, is that for the most part, most of the contents, most of the documents, including contracts, and not just oral contracts, written contracts by a company, are signed on behalf of a company, although it is true that the judge will say in that case that sometimes it is an artificial distinction as to whether something is done by a company or on behalf of a company. It is always done on behalf of a company because you can't get a company with a pen and write itself. A company can put, or a company officer can put a seal, and that signifies that it's been done by a company. But something is done without a seal, signed by somebody on behalf of a company, in the main, will be regarded as a document signed on behalf of the company, even if it's signed by a director. And there is provision in section 72 that where document or contract doesn't distinguish between oral and written, it must include written contract. So where a contract is signed on behalf of a company, so long as that person has authority to sign, and expressly this is provided that authority can be expressed or implied in the normal course of events, and we're all familiar with those provisions. So long as that is the case, it is sufficient for one person, the authorized person, to sign that contract on behalf of the company. That is the analysis that has been made for me. As I said, this originates from the industry. It is already established practice in the UK. It seems to be working well, and therefore we have decided for the sake of certainty to produce that. And it also provides, as I have mentioned to the Honourable Member, that although we could take issues on board and say, well, let's make it even clearer, let's change a word here or a word there, that may well destroy the jurisprudence that comes out in the UK if we don't reflect the wording that has been interpreted by courts in the UK. So it is always useful. And we don't have to slavishly follow what the UK does in England. But when we are adopting those provisions, it is useful to spoil the word, because then the jurisprudence from the court will be applied equally in intervals, and that is always a useful provision. So I am, the government is satisfied that this is what the industry wants, and that it works well, and it has been shown to work well, so we have no particular concerns about those added burdens that the Honourable Member mentioned. The other point is in relation to financial unhappiness. Because I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for giving way. Simply to point out a point that I intended to make when I made my contribution, but escaped me, that and acknowledge that other than the issue that I've raised in relation to Clause 72, etc., in relation to execution of documents, acknowledge that what is there now is by far a huge improvement to what is the position in the current Act, which is, I think, Section 47. I think it does provide for clarity, a clarity which wasn't, which is certainly not there under the current legislation in Britain.
I'll now put the question.
I haven't finished dealing with it. I just gave way to the other member. I was just seeking clarification. I wanted to go over to the event. The other point that the Honourable Member raised is the question of financial assistance. And that is an issue that has been live with respect to this for a number of years, and what changes should be made to that. And we pondered on the various options. The options that we had available was to adopt the provisions that are currently contained in the 1985 Act in the UK, which are essentially the one generally called the welfare provisions, whereby a procedure can be followed to make things right, or to renew the prohibition on financial assistance altogether, as they have done in the 2006 Act. The advice that I was given, which I have also shared with the Honourable Member in terms of what I was told, was that coupled with the removal in 2006 was a codification, as one of the members already alluded to, of direct execution in the UK Act. In Gibraltar, we haven't gone as far as codifying for direct execution, and we will continue to rely on common law provisions. And because there were specific statutory duties, it appears within the UK to say that would be sufficient for that protection, and therefore there was no need to keep the prohibition on financial assistance, and that's why they moved down that route in 2006. In Gibraltar, we have had consultations with practitioners, we have looked at the provision extensively, and eventually we decided that the better option was to go for what they had previously, because we are not codifying those directive duties in the Act, and therefore we're following the 1985 Act. The Honourable Member has said this is not something specifically as a matter of policy of the government. There's no particular policy, it's just doing what is best for the jurisdiction and for practitioners and what works well. We will now have a provision which will allow the welfare procedure subject to certain steps being taken. And yes, it is true, as the Honourable Member has said, that certain steps will have to be taken, and that will incur some time and some funds for the fund. But that is what we have felt is the best option for the industry in Gibraltar, having regard to what they've done in the UK more recently, and the reasons why they did it, and we haven't followed fully what they have done in the UK in this. So that is the explanation in relation to financial assistance. It simply remains me again to thank all Honourable Members for their contribution, for their very positive contribution to this, and for the fact that this has been welcomed by the whole House.
I now put the question.
which is that a bill for an act to re-enact with amendments the provisions of the Companies Act 1913-07 as amended to incorporate the Companies Accounts Act 1999 and the Companies Consolidated Accounts Act 1999 to take account of the effect of the Insolvency Act, to incorporate amendments proposed by the Law Reform Committee of the Gibraltar Finance Centre Council, and for connected purposes be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Companies Act 2014.
I think I'd best to give notice of the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today, and later today, if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that committee stage and third reading of this bill be taken today.
A bill for an act to amend the Insolvency Act 2011. The Honourable Minister of Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Insolvency Act 2011 be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Insolvency Act 2011 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Insolvency Amendment Act 2014.
Speaker, I beg to move that a bill for an act to amend the Insolvency Act 2011 be read a second time. Speaker, we have already heard this morning this arises from a need to change certain changes, minor changes, to an act which was passed by Parliament in 2011. The Insolvency Act is also an extensive act which was passed by my predecessor, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition, when he was Minister for Justice. And certainly a great deal of work went into putting that together as well, and that must be acknowledged today. The bill was passed, as I think you recall, in June 2011, but it hasn't been commenced yet. And it hasn't been commenced for a number of reasons. Firstly, there was a need to finalise the drafting of a number of pieces of regulations and rules. Though there are, in fact, strict rules and regulations, and I'll go through them later, which required to be finalised, those are now just about in their final form. And there was a need also to pass, apart from this bill, the other bill which I will, the related bill which I will be moving today, which is the Insolvency Consequences Provision Bill. And that, in the form that it was previously, necessarily made amendments to the existing Companies Act. We felt that it made no sense when we were overhauling the Companies Act to, for the sake of postponing 1 or 2 months or 3 or 4 months, to introduce these provisions and to commence the Insolvency Act, make amendments, wholesale amendments to the Companies Act as it is, and then come back to Parliament a couple of months later and make all those amendments again to reflect the changes in the new Companies Act. So that didn't make sense. And it makes sense, we say, to put it all together as one overall revision of company and insolvency legislation. Part of it had already been enacted in 2011, and the rest we're doing today. And in the same way as it is proposed that the Companies Act be commenced on the 1st of September 2011, we will be publishing very shortly the various pieces of regulations, not commencing them, but just publishing for public knowledge, and again to give practitioners the opportunity to get to grips with the whole new regime, the whole new insolvency regime, which will commence at the same time as the new Companies Act on the 1st of September of this year. In relation to this particular bill, Mr. Speaker, this is in the main a housekeeping bill, in that it introduces changes which are necessary or desirable to the Insolvency Act 2011 as a result of the provisions of the Companies Act, which we are enacting today, and in order to make a number arising from the decisions which we have taken since we've been in office, following consultation with the practitioners in the field of insolvency. The amendment consequent to the enactment of the Companies Act consists simply of updating of references in the Insolvency Act to the new Companies Act, because the existing Companies Act clearly was done having regard to the existing Companies Act, and some of the terminology will need to be changed. So what we're doing is generally ensuring that there is consistency of terminology between the sequence of legislation, the existing Insolvency Act and the new Companies Act. There are also a number of corrections to the Insolvency Act, consisting primarily of rectifying cross-referencing errors and a number of typographical errors which we noted. There are, as I said, also a number of changes to the Insolvency Act which are being made, and these have followed consultation. And I will go through the various changes. There are simply four changes. The first, Mr. Speaker, is to provide for the licensing of insolvency practitioners by the Financial Services Commission. The Insolvency Act 2011 provides for this function to be exercised by the Minister with responsibility for financial services. The Act of Fact distinguishes in relation to insolvency practitioners between the licensing of insolvency practitioners, which is the responsibility given to the Minister, and the supervision of insolvency practitioners, which is the responsibility given to the Financial Services Commission. The Act of Fact allows the Minister to designate another person or entity as essentially the licensing authority. The government has decided that that function should not be exercised by the Minister, but by the Commission. The licensing function should be exercised by the Commission. And although it is true that this could have been done by designation under the existing provision, we were in an event as a result of the Companies Act bringing an amendment to the Insolvency Act. And the government's position is not that the primary power and the statute should be held by the Minister, subject to a designation, but that the statute power should be held by the Commission itself. And therefore, we felt that it was best to do this by bringing this amendment to the Act. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, we have widened the scope of what is currently contained in Sections 1-6-3 of the Insolvency Act. This provides that where there is any inconsistency between the Act and legislation transposing EU directives on collateral arrangements and securities, the EU provision naturally prevails. However, Section 1-6-3, which is the current provision that is reflected, is limited to set-offs. The amendment makes it clear that this applies to all arrangements and transactions caused by the relevant collateral and securities laws. Thirdly, we have placed the responsibility for distributing the report on the outcome of a creditors' meeting on the interim supervisor. We have done this because it is the interim supervisor and not the chairman, at the moment under the Act of the responsibility of the chairman, but it is the interim supervisor that prepares the report on the creditors' meeting, and it is because of the interim supervisor who will be better placed to have the obligation to distribute that report. And fourthly, we have provided that when considering the appointment of a liquidator in a public interest ground, the court must include the interest of the public outside to the open. And we have done this because we have been advised that it has previously been argued in proceedings that public may only mean, should only mean, the public in the open. And if that were to be the case, it could possibly undermine the confidence of overseas investors in Gibraltar companies if we don't take their interest into account, the court was not to take their interest into account. Mr. Speaker, the existing company debt provides for certain offences for both solvent and for insolvent liquidations. We consider that offences in the new Companies Act should apply only to solvent liquidations, and the equivalent offences for insolvent liquidations should be placed in the Insolvency Act. The bill before the House gives effect to this. Finally, Mr. Speaker, we have given notice by letter to Mr. Speaker of a further amendment which we will be proposing at committee stage. And I understand honourable members have a copy of the letter with a proposed amendment. The purpose of the amendment is to introduce a new provision in the Insolvency Act which reflects the current Section 42A of the Bankruptcy Act. And as members know, the Bankruptcy Act will be repealed when the Insolvency Act is commenced. Section 42A of the Bankruptcy Act contains provisions relating to asset protection trusts. These are not used to any particularly great extent, as I understand it. However, there have been regulations made under Section 42A, and that is the Bankruptcy Registered Disposition Regulation, and a number of dispositions are in fact registered under the existing regulations. We have received representation from the industry. It would be desirable to keep the equivalent of Section 42A in the new Insolvency Act. The government has agreed, and we will therefore be proposing estimating a new clause to the bill which will give effect to that. Mr. Speaker, as with the Companies Act, as I've already indicated, it is the government's intention to commence all the legislation on the 1st September 2014. And at the same time, a number of rules and regulations will be commenced and previously been published. And these are the insolvency rules, the insolvency transitional provisions regulation, the insolvency partnership regulation, the insolvency administration of insolvency state regulations, the insolvency particular regulations, and the insolvency cross-border insolvency regulations. And once again, Mr. Speaker, I wish to thank all those who have been involved and assisted and advised the government in putting together the various plans of this undoubtedly complex process. In particular, I would thank members of what we call the insolvency group, who are a group of practitioners in insolvency work who have for the last 2 years been involved with myself and the Minister for Financial Services in consultation, advice, and have reviewed various drafts, in particular the draft of the rules and regulations which are necessary to give effect to the provisions of the Insolvency Act. I would also extend the government's appreciation for their input to the Financial Services Commission, in particular the Commission's Chief Executive, Samantha Barras. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any other member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill?
Well, for the record of the doubt that the opposition will be supporting this bill. This bill is introduced in order to allow for amendments to the Insolvency Act, which at the end of the Minister for Justice and acknowledged was introduced into this Parliament by us when we were in government, not only to enable it to be commenced, but also they made a number of amendments. Whilst perhaps we would have dealt with certain issues differently, and indeed in terms of the amendments to the licensing regime, we took a conscious decision to deal with it in a different way. The reality is that there is more than one way to skin a cat, and simply because we decided to deal with it differently doesn't mean that there is anything wrong in the way that the Honourable Gentleman has sought to deal with this particular issue. So the opposition will be supporting the bill for those reasons.
Because it's just one minor point on which I'm very specific to the Honourable Minister for handling the act as it stands. I was a little bit concerned when he said that the effect of the amendment to 1529 was to define the public interest as including the public interest of a place outside of the border. I think that might be a misspeaking on his part. I think, in fact, it does something slightly different in that it defines public. I think the public place we all know about the border, which is slightly different to defining the public interest. I think it would be dangerous as a matter of generality to define the public interest in the laws of Gibraltar as the public interest of every country in the world and the public interest of some countries is that the voters are not at the finance center, still not have laws to encourage new people. And therefore, I think as a matter of general statutory provision, it would be very careful thought before the definition of public interest were broadened in that way. I don't think that that would be a fair outcome, even though I think I will describe it. I don't think, on a very quick reading, that is the effect of this amendment, which is simply to do probably what is already the position, and that is simply that we're first public, as in members of the public. It means members of the public who are both in and out of Gibraltar, and that makes it clear that the creditor of the Gibraltar company is a member of the public in Gibraltar for that purpose already. On that basis, there is a provision in 229 that refers to the public interest. The court is of the opinion that it is in the public interest for a liquidator to be appointed. The amendment is public, includes public within and outside the vote, or whether that would influence the interpretation of the word public, whether the reference to the public in that sense would influence the interpretation of the word, the phrase public interest, if you include the word public, I don't know. But I don't think it's hugely important in the context, in any event, I don't think it's hugely important in the context of this legislation. But I think it's worth just bearing in mind, in perhaps in other legislation where it might be more sensitive, have focus on this point. Mr. Speaker, I agree entirely with the clarification and interpretation given by the Honourable Member Speaker Caruana. Certainly, it is not our intention to signal that the government considers it any reference to public interest as anything other than the public interest in Gibraltar. There is a particular provision here in relation to the public and what that means, and public must necessarily for insolvency purposes, and we're only dealing with this, and therefore we're making no wider statement than what is concerned in this particular bill. It's to clarify the public for these purposes means public in Gibraltar and outside because of the interest of people outside Gibraltar into those companies who may be affected by this amendment. Therefore, I am happy to agree with the clarification which will be put for the amendment. In fact, very grateful for it.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to provide for the repeal and amendment of certain enactments consequent on the enactment of the Insolvency Act 2011 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against, carried. The Insolvency Amendment Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice of the committee's third and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that committee's third and third reading of the bill be taken today. A bill for an act to provide for the repeal and amendment of certain enactments consequent on the enactment of the Insolvency Act 2011. The Honourable Minister for Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to provide for the repeal and amendment of certain enactments consequent on the enactment of the Insolvency Act 2011 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to provide for the repeal. Why didn't you just stand that one? Therefore, an act to provide for the repeal and amendment of certain enactments consequent on the enactment of the Insolvency Act 2011 due to the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Insolvency Consequential Provisions Act 2013.
I think that I best remove that the Insolvency Consequential Provisions Bill 2013 be read for a second time. This bill makes amendments to various acts, regulations, and rules arising from the enactment of the Insolvency Act 2011, as amended by the bill we have just considered. As the name of the bill implies, the intention is to give effect to this bill to changes which are necessary or desirable simply as a consequence of the enactment of the Insolvency Act. As honourable members are well aware, the Insolvency Act 2011 introduces the concept of administration for companies. This makes it necessary for various statutory provisions to be amended to reflect the fact that companies, apart from being placed into liquidation, may also now be placed into administration. As an example, Mr. Speaker, the application of the Crime, Money Laundering and Postage Act 2007 and the Drug Trafficking Offences Act 1995 is extended to assets held by companies which are subject to administration under the new procedure. A number of amendments are also being made to the Protect the Sale Companies Act. Although such special provisions apply in relation to the liquidation of a Protect the Sale Company, there is no reason to exclude the Insolvency Act completely. However, in relation to individual sales, the Protect the Sale Companies Act provides for the appointment of an administrator. This is a self-contained procedure within that act, and the proposed new section 2A of that act therefore excludes the administration provision in the Insolvency Act because the act already has its own procedure. Other amendments are also making a possible subject change in terminology in the Insolvency Act. These are the other pieces of legislation which are amended by this bill. Are the Deposit Guarantee Scheme Act 1997, Financial Services, Financial Markets and Insolvency Settlement Finality Regulations 2011, Financial Services Commission Act 2007, Financial Services Temporary Administration of Companies Act 2010, and the Supreme Court Rules 2000. The Speaker has amended this bill as well.
Before I put the question, does any other member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? I will now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to provide the repeal and amendment of certain enactments consequent on the enactment of the Insolvency Act 2011 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Insolvency Consequential Provisions Act 2014.
Speaker, I beg to give notice of the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today. Committee stage, no one
will Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House should resolve itself in committee to consider the following bills clause by clause. The Companies Bill 2014, the Insolvency Amendments Bill 2014, and the Insolvency Consequential Provisions Bill 2014.
A bill for an act to re-enact with amendment the provisions of the Companies Act 1930-07 as amended, to incorporate the company's accounts Act 1999 and the company's consolidated accounts Act 1999, to take account of the effects of the Insolvency Act, to incorporate amendments proposed via Law Reform Committee of the Gibraltar Finance and Accounting, and for connected purposes. Clauses 1 to 17.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 18.
Chairman, I have given notice in a letter, which I understand honourable members have, of various amendments to this bill, including an amendment to clause 18. I'm happy to go through the various amendments or for the record to show that these amendments are formally put before the committee.
Well, honourable members agree that, having regard to the fact that it has been circulated in detail, we dispense with the actual willingness to actually read them out.
Agreed.
Clause 18, as amended, and part of the bill.
Clause 19 to 85.
And part of the bill.
Clause 86.
Honourable Mr. Equally.
Now, our amendments have been covered by the general amendment, and we can say that it is covered by the general amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that all the amendments have been accepted, and therefore, this is the clause 86 as amended, which stands part of the bill.
Clause 86 as amended stands part of the bill.
Clauses 87 to 113.
And part of the bill.
Clause 114.
Again, there is an amendment which has been circulated. So, clause 114 as amended, and part of the bill.
Clauses 115 to 130.
And part of the bill.
Clause 131.
Clause 131, as amended, stands part of the bill.
Clause 132 to 187.
Stands part of the bill.
Clause 188.
Clause 188, as amended, stands part of the bill.
Clause 189.
Clause 189 as amended stands part of the bill.
Clauses 190 and 191
stand part of the bill.
Clause 192.
Clause 192 as amended stands part of the bill.
Clauses 193 to 490.
And part of the bill.
Schedules 1 to Schedule 29.
And part of the bill.
The long title.
And part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Insolvency Act 2011. Clause 1.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 2.
Mr. Chairman, I have given notice by letter of a proposed amendment to Clause 2 to introduce a new 35A.
and the details are set out in the letter which I understand have been circulated to the honourable members opposite, as I explained during the second reading, which is to reintroduce the provisions relating to asset protection funds.
Is it agreed that for two, as amended in the term the honourable member has given notice, stand part of the bill? Clause 2 as amended, stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to provide for the repeal and amendment of certain enactments consequent on the enactment of the Insolvency Act 2011. Clauses 1 to 3 and the long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011. The report at the end. Yes. A bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011, the Honourable Minister of Education, Telecommunications and Justice,
Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 be read for the first time.
I now put the question that a bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 be read for the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Criminal Procedure and Evidence Amendment Act 2011.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that the bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 be read for the second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill introduces a number of amendments to the Act so as to increase the range of sentences to which rehabilitation attaches and to decrease the rehabilitation period in respect of certain sentences. The provisions regarding the rehabilitation of offenders introduced in the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 aim to give those with convictions or cautions the chance, in certain circumstances, to have their convictions or cautions regarded as spent after a specified period of time, known as the rehabilitation period. The length of that specified period depends on how the individual concerned with status, including the length of prison sentence where such a sentence has been imposed. Prison sentences of over 30 months are excluded from the scope of the act and can therefore never become spent, subject, of course, to the possibility of a review, which the amendments we have previously introduced. The rehabilitation period for other types of sentence vary according to the person's age and whether the person is cautioned or convicted, and, if the latter, the type of sentence imposed. Once the conviction or caution becomes spent, the offender is regarded as rehabilitated and, for most purposes, is treated as if he had never committed the offence. The amendments included in this bill are based on recent changes in the United Kingdom making the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, and these amendments came into force on the 10th of March 2014. As a result of the amendments in the UK, there is now a very wide gap between rehabilitation periods in the UK and those in Gibraltar. As an example, someone sentenced to 6 months imprisonment in the UK has a rehabilitation period of 4 years, whereas someone sentenced to the same period of imprisonment in Gibraltar has a rehabilitation period of 10 years, as it were, more than double. The UK regime was amended following criticism after it had been inconsistent with the contemporary sentencing practice, with the result that it failed in its aim to help reformed offenders resettle into society. It was suggested that the rehabilitation periods were too long and did not reflect the point at which reoffending tails off following a conviction. When these changes were introduced in the UK in March of this year, a number of reports also suggested that studies have shown that shorter rehabilitation periods made a critical difference on whether or not an offender was able to find employment and turn his or her life around. That in turn also reflected on reoffending rates. Shorter periods of rehabilitation resulted, therefore, in offenders being more likely to find employment and in turn less likely to reoffend. That does not, of course, mean or lead to the conclusion that rehabilitation periods should be eliminated altogether. It is necessary to have rehabilitation periods. The question is simply what those periods should be. The UK has now fixed those periods at a level considerably shorter than those which currently apply in Gibraltar. They appear to the government to be sound public policy, criminal justice policy, and social policy reasons for these shorter periods. We have therefore decided to follow the periods recently changed success in the UK. The changes in the bill involve two key matters. The first change is to extend the scope of the Act to cover the serious sentences of up to 48 months. And the second is to change the length of some of the rehabilitation periods and the manner in which they are calculated. These changes will result in a simpler system which will no doubt help in a more realistic opportunity being given to the offenders to get on the right path and contribute to society. That is in line with government policy, as reflected in our manifesto, where we set out the importance of rehabilitation of offenders' provisions. Other changes are simply to simplify the system in line with current UK practice. So, Speaker, I commend the bill to them.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? The Honourable Louisa Richardson.
This bill seeks to amend legislation that we introduced into this House, I think it was in 2011, in the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Bill, which introduced for the very first time into Gibraltar the concept of rehabilitation of offenders. Mr. Speaker, I recall from the debate in relation to that bill that, in fact, the Honourable Gentleman that he was shadowing, he raised a number of concerns about the shortness of the rehabilitation period. He also raised some concerns as well as to the schedule and to the bill, which listed all those professions. You may recall all those professions that are actually being excluded. And I told him then that really the question of rehabilitation of offenders was very much work in progress, and that it may well have been that at some point in the future, a future Gibraltar government would have to review the rehabilitation period and indeed also the exclusion, the list of professions that were excluded from being people working in those professions were excluded from being rehabilitated at some point in the future. The Honourable Gentleman decided to do this at this point in time because what he's doing is he's following UK amendments to the legislation in the UK. I think that it is something that actually ought to be kept under constant review, and it is something that may well in the future lend itself to Gibraltar going down a different path to the United Kingdom, particularly too in relation to re-examination of all those professions that are excluded from being rehabilitated. I just explain for the benefit of viewers that there is a list of professions annexed to the Criminal Evidence and Procedure Act, as it now is, and anybody wanting to work in those professions will never be rehabilitated. In other words, a conviction will always, no matter how spent the conviction would have become, would always
very effectively against that person when that person wanted to work in those professions. And of course, that makes sense in relation to, for example, professions such as people working with children or with vulnerable people. But indeed, the list is actually a very wide list indeed. We chose to follow the UK because at the time we thought that was appropriate. But I think that is something that also ought to be examined by the government, and I urge you, as part of this continuing process, and of course keeping our laws updated, that we should look at that. But other than that, Mr. Speaker, the opposition will certainly be supporting this bill. Yes, Mr. Speaker. The honourable member mentioned certain issues that were raised at the second reading of the bill in 2011. I have no independent recollection of that, but be that as it may, I do agree that this legislation, as many other legislation, pieces of legislation, need to be kept under constant review. The review that we have done now in relation to the periods do arise because of changes in the UK. The honourable member has mentioned, and again he is correct, as I acknowledged earlier in the context of a separate bill, that we should not, and we do not need to follow slavery in Gibraltar, whatever happens in the UK. So it is not that it is a reaction to a change in the UK, but a consequence of consideration of the reasons why those changes have been made, and the studies that have led to the criticism of the longer period that have led to those changes. And after some consideration of the reasons, and those changes were only made in March of this year, we have felt that it makes sense to move in that particular direction. But I do acknowledge that there will be no circumstances which may make us in the future go down in different directions to the UK. I also agree that the list of professions, which is quite extensive, needs to be kept under review. We have not decided at this stage that we should make any particular changes, but it is something that certainly needs to be kept under review. As we see how the effect of the changes of the introduction in the first place, and let's be sure that although this was introduced in Parliament in 2011, it didn't actually come into effect until November, I think we recall, of 2000. The whole act came into effect in November 2012, but very early on in 2012, we introduced the rehabilitation of offenders' provisions as a commencement of a path on its own. So this is not something that has been around for years and years, and we have learned from the practice as to what it actually means to people who come out of jail and end their rehabilitation period. The main part, people who have been subject to rehabilitation periods since the commencement have not had the opportunity to have that period end and then be rehabilitated. This will certainly help because it will automatically mean that somebody who is currently subject to a longer rehabilitation period, who is caught by the new provision, will have that period automatically shortened, and therefore that person may well now find, as a result of this commencement, that conviction becomes spent and has those extra opportunities, which is what we all want to achieve. So certainly, this is a matter that needs to be kept under review, and I'm certainly grateful that on this occasion the opposition is supporting the change of the amendment.
I now take a question, which is a bill for an act to amend the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Criminal Procedure and Evidence Amendment Act 2011.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice of the committee state on third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that committee state on third reading of the bill be taken today. A bill for an act to amend the Prison Act 2011, the Honourable Minister of Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Prison Act 2011 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Prison Act 2011 be heard the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Prison Amendment Act 2014.
Speaker, I'd like to move that the bill for an act to amend the Prison Act 2011 be read the second time. Speaker, we seem to be dealing with a number of amendments to acts which were passed by the Parliament in 2011. For some reason, yes, certainly very welcome. For some reason, there seems to have been a flurry of activity in 2011 to get some legislation through from Parliament. But this was certainly a welcome amendment, a welcome provision, an update of the Prison Act, which a very forward welcome by all. But you see, so this thing includes a number of amendments to the Prison Act 2011, which can be split into three groups. The first set of provisions of amendments is contained in clauses 2 and 3. These deal with the position of prisoners aged 17 and their classification under the Act. The changes ensure that persons aged 17 are also treated as juveniles during the judicial process under the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act and also under the Prison Act. At present, special treatment is required under the Prison Act for those aged under 17. This does not, of course, include 17-year-olds. Honourable members will recall that I explained in answer to a question from the Honourable Sergeant Vieira in March of this year how juveniles who are detained at Haitian prison are dated, and it became apparent during the course of preparing the answer to that question that whereas in prison 17-year-olds are treated as adults, because it's only under 17 that are given that special treatment. So, in prison, 17-year-olds are treated as adults. Under the Criminal Procedure and the Evidence Act, 17-year-olds are treated as juveniles. This discrepancy exists as a result of the commencement of the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act in 2012, which changed the age at which young persons become adults from 17 to 18. And this discrepancy, in fact, Mr. Speaker, was also highlighted in a recent case before the court, which was reported by the Judicial Chronicle on the 5th of April of this year. As a result, Mr. Speaker, the government considers that it is right for 17-year-olds to be treated as juveniles for all purposes under the criminal justice system. It is therefore necessary to amend the Prison Act to bring the classification of 17-year-olds in line with the definition of juveniles in the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act. Speaker, the second area being amended by this bill is contained in clause 4. This amendment clarifies the way in which a sentence of imprisonment is defined for the purposes of release on license. The amendment reflects the current practice that terms in default for the non-payment of fines are for the purposes of releasing persons on license treated as sentences of imprisonment, and that consecutive terms of imprisonment are to be treated as one term. This arises where a prisoner is serving a sentence of imprisonment and separately has to serve a term of, say, 30 days in default for non-payment of fines. The question that arises is how is the parole eligibility date calculated? Is it only by reference to the first sentence with a term in default set separately, or is there a requirement to put the two terms together as one term and calculate parole eligibility date by reference to that whole term? The legislation, Mr. Speaker, I was advised was not clear, or the practice was to treat the sentences as one term. The amendment we are making does not change the current practice, it simply clarifies the law. The final amendment made by this bill about clause 5, Mr. Speaker, these are amendments to section 64 of the Prison Act 2011 to create a new offence for possession without authorization of a device capable of transmitting or receiving images, sound, or information by electronic communications in a prison. This includes mobile telephones, as well as other devices which are capable of accessing the internet or are otherwise capable of sending or receiving data. There is already, under the Prison Act, the offense of introducing such a device into the prison. This requires evidence of who introduced the device to the prison, but does not assist where someone is in possession of the device, but it is not known who or by whom the device was introduced to the prison. It was felt that this creates a lacuna in our legislation, which we are correcting with this new offence. The new offence will also extend the possession of any component, part, or article designed or adapted for use with such a device, such as a SIM card or a charger for a mobile telephone. The speaker, I commend the bill to us.
Put a question, is any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, yes. Mr. Speaker, in the mutual backslapping that has characterized particular session this morning, it was the first and generous comment by the honourable gentleman to suggest that we had delayed all these bills, the Insolvency Act, the Criminal Evidence of Procedure, the Crime Act, but quick enough, all several people in the legislation and until the very end. Of course, the reality is that Dealing, as you well know, because of the work that he's done in relation to the Companies Act, that dealing with legislation of this nature isn't like, I suppose, flying an egg, although I have to say I have very little experience of flying eggs or flying anybody else. Anything else, much to my wife's complaint. But Mr. Speaker, these are just simply amendments. One of the amendments deals with an anomaly that has arisen, or that attention has been drawn to an anomaly as a consequence of a recent case in the Supreme Court. I happened to read the case, and it's logical that the government comes to Parliament in order to introduce an amendment that will effectively make the provisions in the prisons compatible with the provisions in other pieces of legislation. And for all those reasons, Mr. Speaker, as your position will be supporting this bill. Mr. Speaker, just to say that I wasn't trying to be angelic, I was simply remarking on a fact, and in fact I was implicitly trying to commend the member for bringing all those, as he has often described them, as feminist pieces of legislation before he was, unfortunately for him, as the right elected.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act from the Prison Act 2011 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Prison Amendment Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, may I now bow on 1 o'clock and invite the House to recess until 2:30 this afternoon?
House will now recess until 2:30 this afternoon.